In this sermon, we will explore the fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large, and we will identify the invisible enemy of democracy. Good morning.
Good morning.
This particular principle that we affirm and promote, the right of conscience in our congregations and society at large. This is a particularly difficult time to do this principle, I must say. I had some depressing moments, some hopeful moments, and I appreciate very much the reading today. I thought first I'd start by reading, by talking about a bit about the right of conscience and what that might mean and how that might come about. And when we think about the term conscience, what do we think about? We think of morality, we think of right and wrong, we think of ethics, we think of the capacity to think about what's going on with ourselves, in our community, in our families, in our societies, and then the ability to come to some kind of conclusion about the morality of where we are and what we've seen, and interpret from a set of principles what we have seen. Conscience does not happen automatically. It is a result of a particular way of rearing children. You can be an adult and not have a moral compass. You can be an adult and not have ethics to function out of. You can be an adult and be tyrannical. You can be a tyrant and not know you're being a tyrant. Being a tyrant without the capacity to think and make meaning and reflect and have empathy is normal. No concern for the other. And we can see this throughout time, and we question it. How can somebody treat somebody else like that? How can these particular crimes happen? How can these national leaders treat their people like that? And when we look through history, we can find many, many examples of where leaders of countries have been absolutely horrible to their citizens. And we ask, how can that happen? There is no development of a conscience, a sense of morality, a sense of right and wrong. Furthering that difficulty as far as Unitarian Universalists are concerned, we affirm and promote that we have a right to conscience in the process, in a democratic process. I'm trying to think, what does that mean? I believe this is what that means, or it is a meaning within many definitions, but this is one. That we come together as a people and we conclude certain things. And we believe that out of our conscience, we believe out of our morality, out of our ethical codes, that this decision is right, not to deregulate all the regulations protecting our environment, the letter we sent to President Bush addressing those issues. So we send our thought up in the air. We send our thought to our government, in which we have a belief that our government, our Congress, our Senate, the legislative process will indeed represent us and speak our moral code and speak our ethics as we let them know what that is. That is our right, we believe. Well, what happens when we send that message to our representatives and it is ignored, or even it is signed into law in the public eye, and then when the public eye turns and focuses on something else, there is another law added to that law by executive privilege saying, I don't have to pay attention to this law. Now, I know for a fact that Bill Clinton, 140 times, did not pay any attention to the laws, moved past the boundaries of the Constitution. Know that George Bush, in the first 4 years of his term as president, 232 times, more than anybody else, disregarded the laws, disregarded the right of conscience that the people send to the government, disregarded that. We now have legal scholars saying we are in a time that's unprecedented, that the executive branch of our government is gaining power and taking power away from the Supreme Court and taking the power away from the legislative branch. Now, a lot of us, I would say that we would maybe focus on the president of today and point fingers. That would be a mistake. This is a process that has evolved specifically, I think, more directly than before, and we'll get to more history later, for over 26 years. What we're seeing today is the fruit of 26 years of attacking the congressional and attacking the Supreme Court's balance of power and giving more power to the executive branch. And when I began to understand that, I began to ask this question: where have we been? Where have we been? This is 26 years old. This is a movement that has gone through time. And we are at a place in time where we are not going to be able to implement one of our principles, or it will have no meaning. Right of conscience. Now next, how do we understand this democratic process? How do we understand the word democracy or the process of democracy, a people, democracy that rule, whether it's through representation or whether it's through directness? How we can come up with a definition, and we can talk about a definition. But does that get at democracy? Does that help us understand democracy? And I'm going to suggest today it does not. Because to fully understand something as the way I understand experience, it leads to not only information, not only knowledge, but it also leads to an interpretation of that knowledge, which also leads to, as we talked about before, also leads to some kind of decision about the truth, which then leads to some kind of behavior. So really, to understand democracy, we've got to understand the experience of democracy over time, or the experience of the struggle of democracy. And I'm going to make a suggestion today that we have not lived in a democracy. That what the Bill of Rights does and what the Constitution does is it creates a foundation in which democracy can evolve, if the citizens pay attention, if the citizens are involved. Because when the citizens are not involved, we can have the Bill of Rights and we can have the Constitution, but we can also not have a democracy. And I think it's helpful to understand that is to recognize that I have been living under the historical truth that our nation was born and England was the mother of our nation and we were born by separating from England. That's what was taught to me and that's what I believed. And so in my mind, I always see redcoats, the struggle against the British soldiers. However, that's not true. In 1600, Queen Elizabeth I called together 214 merchants and nobles and said, we're going to create a corporation called the East Indian Company. And that corporation we're creating is directly to go against and be competitive with the Dutch company who had control of the spice market of the world. What happened within that next 100 years, the East Indian Company was a corporate state ruler in India and owned the land which we say we colonized, Jamestown. That was owned by a company that was a subsidiary of the East Indian Company. New England, these lands were owned by a company. They were not owned by England. Now, this company had its own military force at one time, and it's had its own police force at one time, but a Dutch military and Dutch police force massacred this police force at one and military force at one time. So the East Indian Company went to the British Empire and said, we need your military to defend our interests. And the empire, since they had stock in this company, said yes. We will use our military to defend your interest. So when we were fighting the British soldiers for independence, we were fighting an army that's symbolically representing a corporation, not a nation. And I think to understand democracy in this country, we need to know that that's how our country was born, that that was what we were rebelling against, oppression of a corporation who was getting power from a nation through their military force so that they could implement laws and could implement taxation to oppress the people in which they owned the land and owned that whole process. The East Indian Company paid for a lot of passages over to this country from England. They facilitated a lot of things. When we try to understand democracy in this country, we need to see a river that flows through time of these three forces: people, the government, and business. If we don't have an awareness of those three dynamics and how they interplay with one another, we will not be able to understand the struggle for democracy, and we will not know how to fight for democracy. When we can vote laws into legislation and they can be ignored, which the present executive branch, and again, this is out of a 26-year history, the present executive branch has said they can ignore 750 laws. I have the article, and we can look at that. 750 laws we can ignore. The Abu Ghraib, the prison, torture, there were some laws Congress passed, and as soon as the president signed that law, after everybody left, the executive branch turned around and said, well, we don't have to pay attention to that law. In terms of the military, as far as Congress relations to the military and the executive branch of the military, the executive branch says we don't have to pay attention to anything with the military because we can make it up because I'm commander-in-chief. These have tremendous implications for our fifth principle. So when we look through time, we begin this country and we can look at the difference between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. Did you know Thomas Jefferson in the Bill of Rights, one of the things that he had in that Bill of Rights was commerce free of not being able to be dominated by monopolies, freedom from monopolies? I didn't know that. I knew that Thomas Jefferson got the Bill of Rights in by a very difficult fight with John Adams being a Federalist implementing a foundations that were good for business. I also know that after John Adams, Federalists disappeared because the people didn't want the Federalists anymore. But however, the laws were in there that were favoring business. The very laws that would produce the exact same thing that the Revolution was about. So Thomas Jefferson was for the individual, was for the populace, and at first even in the senators were appointed. But in 1913, Thomas Jefferson's will became complete because he wanted the people to appoint the senators. But it took until 1913. And only after the populist movement was so disgusted with the abuse of national corporations that they took the right away from the elite to elect senators, to appoint senators, only after that did the populist movement change that law to be more congruent with Thomas Jefferson's will. So when we look through time, for the first 50 years or so, we see this struggle, but we see a counterbalancing force. There were laws against corporations. For example, when in 1830, the First Bank of America was beginning to pay for people to move into political offices, Andrew Jackson said, you can't do that. And they said to Andrew Jackson, we don't care what you say. We're going to do it anyway. At that time, the state and the federal government had laws. We can pull charters. If we don't believe corporations are doing what is good for the people, we can pull their charter. Andrew Jackson pulled their charter, and death came to that corporation. During the Civil War, the corporations gained a tremendous amount of power. So what's beginning to form in my mind, our democracy is about the voice of the citizens standing over against the voice of business, and whoever can move the government has their say. a democracy of the people, the right of conscience, the implementation of a society based on democratic principles is at the heart of who we are as people, as a people. After the Civil War, corporations gained a lot of power in 1913, like I said, that the populist movement came in and put some boundaries on that and changed that back around. Then we had a tremendous movement in our country around there, and it was Woodrow Wilson and the Attorney General named Palmer. What they did was, is they made a decision that they were going to make this country about business, not about the welfare of citizens. So during that period of time, several things happened. One of the things that was happened was the Alien Sedition Act, the second one. John Adams implemented the first one, and here comes the second one, which is a violation of our civil liberties and gives the government permission to violate our civil liberties. Anybody that was associated with a communist or socialist could be arrested. And as a matter of fact, there were several times, several different evenings, there were 5,000, 10,000 people where the government went into people's houses and pulled them out and arrested them and put them in jail and executed some. It's a curious pattern that emerges. Whenever we see pressure and dominance on a citizenship and a struggle with civil liberties, imperialism's going on. Every time we see that, imperialism's going on. So somehow the will of the people might not be for imperialism. After 1913, after this horrible assault on socialist and communist and a government that was policing thought, Franklin Roosevelt won the election, and toward the end of the Second War, Franklin Roosevelt wrote this. And let me tell you something, if you want to read that history, you want to read a hatred about how the business leaders hated Franklin Roosevelt, it is intense. So much so, and I've shared this before, hopefully some of you have checked up to see if it was true or not, so much so, economic fascism, which was started by Mussolini, which Hitler used some of it, which corporations in this country like economic fascism, the government and the corporations ruling the people, they had a representative approach, General Butler. Now, General Butler, he was a general, and he had come up through the ranks, and if you read his history and read what he has to say about the corporations in the United States, he said what the corporations did with him, they would take him and his soldiers and they would send them to the Third World, to South America, and what he would do is defeat the people and defeat the government so that the American corporations can come in, and those are his words, not my words. Well, he said a little better than that. So that's who he is, and the soldiers loved him. Somebody approached him and suggested that they march on Washington and throw Franklin Roosevelt out of office. And General Butler testified that in Congress, it's in the congressional record. It's not my history books, but there it was. We have a tension between big business and the citizens in this country, and we need to watch how that river flows through time in order to understand democracy in this country. After General Butler testified, all that went away, faded away, and nothing came of it. So, and we're going to, this is what we're doing toward the end of the World War II. This is where Roosevelt was in terms of the citizenship of this country. In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. Among these, second Bill of Rights, the right to a useful, remunerative job in industry or shops or farms or mines or nation, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food, clothing, and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad, the right of every family to have a decent home, the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right of adequate protection from economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. America's own rightful place in the world depends in a large part on how fully these similar rights have been carried out into practice for our citizens. Noam Chomsky, in a recent book, Failed States, says this about failed states. There's many characteristics, but this is one he says is in all of the failed states. They fail to protect their citizens. That's a sign of a failed state. They fail to protect their citizens. And I'm suggesting they fail to protect their citizens with rights as Franklin Roosevelt was talking about. They also fail to protect their citizens from aggressors from outside the nation by providing adequate security for the nation. That's a failed state. And when you have a failed state, the more it fails, the less civil liberties you have. Democracy goes away. How do we take our spiritual lives? And I've suggested before that as Unitarian Universalists, there is a tendency for us to know many different spiritualities and understand many different spiritualities. The ministers that move into the ministry of Unitarian Universalism have to know characteristics of many, many different religions and spiritual faiths. The danger in that is we know many things about different religions, but we're not in depth on any one of the religions. We don't have a depth of any one of the spiritualities. For me, if I didn't have a depth of a spiritual tradition, I could not deal with this material. I would numb out. I would want to be hypnotized as if it's not true. I would not want to know it because I feel so helpless. Thank you again for your reading. It is the depth of our spirituality that allows me to back up and look at that and try to understand this with a sense of compassion from the Buddhist, with a sense of unconditional love from our Christian tradition, with a sense of oneness with the earth and with the world and many others from the earth traditions. From those three pillars, I can look at this and I can begin to ask myself, what can I do? Is there something I can do? Think about if those Second Bill of Rights would have, and some of them have been implemented, and how our culture has benefited from the implementation of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, days off, 40-hour work week, the New Deal extended after Roosevelt's death. Truman did not extend the New Deal. Eisenhower did not like the New Deal. Kennedy was going to support some of the New Deal. Johnson's a curious one. He supported the New Deal and moved into social programs at the same time he fed to develop the military-industrial complex. at the same time. Jimmy Carter, he's a curious one too, because you would think automatically he would extend the New Deal, but he did not. After Jimmy Carter, there has been a perpetual attack on the New Deal, of these things that Roosevelt, the ones that were implemented, and in this day and age, the ones that maybe never even thought of again unless we go after and read it. An attack on the structures of our society that provide for the welfare of the citizens. A blatant, all-out attack. So much so, it gets labeled as communist and socialists. I'm very clear about my citizenship in this country. This country is never going to be a socialist country. That's not going to happen. I mean, the powers that be would, and I'm not sure I'd want it to happen. However, we do have the capacity to take care of the citizens with the basic needs. We do have that capacity. And I think what Roosevelt is saying, if we take care of that, the society that stands on that foundation will be prosperous for its citizens. We will be able to implement the fifth principle. What do we do as Unitarian Universalists when we read a fifth principle? When we read our principles and we recognize that we are in a society and a cultural context that says no to our principles. What do we do with that? Do we read them every week? Which we do. I know when I read something and I'm aware of something and I don't do anything about it, I know my spirit either has to numb out, get silent, or it drives me crazy. Just drives me crazy because I know it's there and I have to do something with it. And I know as a citizen, I believe that in my head I say we're a free country and we're a free people, and in many, many ways we are, and in many, many ways does it look like that's fading? Yes. How do we bring our spirituality into our beings and gain enough strength so our voice can be heard, because indeed that's what a democracy is about, that all of our voices are heard and all of our voices make a difference and all of our voices return to us in a sense where our needs are met. That is a democracy where the people rule. How do we do that? I think many of us in this church are doing something. Not like we're not doing anything. We're doing a lot. And we continue to do more. And we will. My encouragement is to deepen our spiritual lives. Whatever faith tradition you pick, deepen that faith tradition. So when we read those principles, these are not just words that float out here. These principles are contained in a sense of compassion. These principles are contained in a sense of love. These principles are contained in a sense of oneness with this earth. And when we have that kind of strength and that kind of solid foundation within us, when we read these principles, we can deal with the action, the behavior we need to take, because we will be motivated to do that. Because when I have that sense of compassion in me, and I see that there are hungry people, or I see that people's pensions are being taken away from them, and they are, they absolutely are. The sense of compassion will move me to challenge the process that's abusing the citizens in this nature. The sense of love moves me to deal with those issues, just as the founders of those religions were moved. I'm going to close with these words. These are times that try souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands now deserves the thanks of men and women. The women that stand now deserve the thanks of men and women. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. Thomas Paine. Thank you.